Hello, and welcome to another episode of Birdie Bot's Every Flavor Pod. I'm your host, Gretchen Badger, and I am so excited to get started with you all. Today, we dive right into Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, chapters 1 through 3. We will start in the absurdly mundane lives of the Dursley family, and then, little by little, we will find ourselves immersed in the magic of the wizarding world. Just a reminder, please make sure to follow the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Story Inc. Pod. That's Story Inc. I-N-C Pod, to stay up to date on all of the goings-on. Tonight, we start with Chapter 1, The Boy Who Lived. Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of Number 4 Privet Drive were proud to say that they were perfectly normal, thank you very much. They were the last people you'd expect to be involved in anything strange or mysterious, because they just didn't hold with such nonsense. And so we begin a journey into a world of witches and wizards and fantasy with a mundane family living in a mundane house on a mundane street, living an extremely mundane existence. In this paragraph, the first paragraph of the entire book, Rowling simultaneously establishes the mundanity of the Muggle world and sets us up to know, even without knowing what this book is even about, to expect for the life of the Dursley family to be turned upside down by something very strange and very mysterious. When Mr. and Mrs. Dursley woke up on the dull gray Tuesday our story starts, there was nothing about the cloudy sky outside to suggest that strange and mysterious things would soon be happening all over the country. Mr. Dursley hummed as he picked out his most boring tie for work, and Mrs. Dursley gossiped away happily as she wrestled a screaming Dudley into his high chair. None of them noticed a large tawny owl flutter past the window. I love how this story starts off in what any adult would call just a normal Tuesday. But Rowling doesn't paint this normality of adulthood from an adult's perspective. She describes the mundanity that is the adulthood of Vernon and Petunia Dursley from a child's perspective. I sometimes forget just how good J.K. Rowling is at writing children's literature. This is a tool in the toolbox of the greatest children's writers of all time. She takes a very normal morning in the life of any adult and views it through the lens of childhood. The normality, the mundanity, is stifling. This writing mechanism, to paint normal adulting from the view of a child, almost sets up the expectation that to understand the wizarding world, to fit into the wizarding world, you have to have a childlike sense of the world. You have to be a little childish. And for a children's fantasy novel, that is genius. As we follow Vernon Dursley through his day, Rowling makes a concerted effort to keep the readers at arm's length from Vernon Dursley. She uses passive tense to describe Vernon's day and his internal reactions to the goings-on in his day. We get to hear his internal voice, his thoughts, but we never get close enough to feel his emotions. It's as if we're watching his internal dialogue happen from behind a wall of glass. We can hear what he's thinking, but we don't even get close to feeling his emotions or living in his mind the way we eventually do with Harry. We follow Vernon to work, seeing odd people with odd clothes, seeing cats with maps. I love that, cats with maps. What a good phrase. Seeing little bits and bops out of place from the mundanity of Muggle London. And Vernon is blissfully unaware of the wizarding world closing in on him and his mundane life at Number 4 Privet Drive. And it's all just little things. Owls in the daytime, oddly dressed individuals, possibly someone talking about his crazy in-laws. Until finally, Vernon runs headfirst into the non-Muggle world to his total dismay. He found it a lot harder to concentrate on drills that afternoon, and when he left the building at 5 o'clock, he was still so worried that he walked straight into someone just outside the door. "Sorry," he grunted, as the tiny old man stumbled and almost fell. It was a few seconds before Mr. Dursley realized that the man was wearing a velvet cloak. He didn't seem at all upset at being almost knocked to the ground. On the contrary, his face split into a wide smile, and he said in a squeaky voice that made passers-by stare,
Don't be sorry, my dear sir, for nothing could upset me today. Rejoice, for you know who has gone at last. Even muggles like yourself should be celebrating this happy, happy day.
And the old man hugged Mr. Dursley around the middle and walked off. Mr. Dursley stood rooted to the spot. He had been hugged by a complete stranger. He also thought he had been called a muggle, whatever that was. He was rattled. He hurried to his car and set off for home, hoping he was imagining things, which he had never hoped before, because he didn't approve of imagination. I just love this interaction. I love Vernon's reaction to it. I love the careless excitement of the wizard he bumped into. I love this. Vernon eventually gets home, seeing the same tabby cat, the cat with a map, from this morning, sitting in the same spot as it was when he left for work. He attempts to bring up the possibility that Petunia's sister and brother-in-law were being talked about openly on the streets of London, and it doesn't go well, so he decides to just drop the subject. He didn't say another word on the subject as they went upstairs to bed. While Mrs. Dursley was in the bathroom, Mr. Dursley crept to the bedroom window and peered down into the front garden. The cat was still there. It was staring down Privet Drive as though it were waiting for something. Was he imagining things? Could all this have anything to do with the Potters? If it did, if it got out that they were related to a pair of... Well, he didn't think he could bear it. The Dursleys got into bed. Mrs. Dursley fell asleep quickly, but Mr. Dursley lay awake, turning it all over in his mind. His last comforting thought before falling asleep was that even if the Potters were involved, there was no reason for them to come near him and Mrs. Dursley. The Potters knew very well what he and Petunia thought about them and their kind. He couldn't see how he and Petunia could get mixed up in anything that might be going on. He yawned and turned over. It couldn't affect them. How very wrong he was. Mr. Dursley might have been drifting into an uneasy sleep, but the cat on the wall outside was showing no sign of sleepiness. It was sitting as still as a statue, its eyes fixed unblinkingly on the far corner of Privet Drive. It didn't so much as move when two owls swooped overhead. In fact, it was nearly midnight before the cat moved at all. A man appeared on the corner the cat had been watching, appeared so suddenly and silently, you'd have thought he'd just popped out of the ground. The cat's tail twitched, and its eyes narrowed. Nothing like this man had ever been seen on Privet Drive. He was tall, thin, and very old, judging by the silver of his hair and beard, which were both long enough to tuck into his belt. He was wearing long robes, a purple cloak that swept the ground, and high-heeled buckled boots. His blue eyes were light, bright, and sparkling behind half-moon spectacles, and his nose was very long and crooked, as though it had been broken at least twice. This man's name was Albus Dumbledore. Ah, take a deep breath. We've escaped the mundane muggle world and have found ourselves finally in the wizarding world. Well, kind of. The wizarding world has found the Dursleys and has found us in the process. We start with the Dursleys heading up to go to bed, ignoring all of the oddities of the day in favor for attempting to return to their normal. Up to this point, the chapter has read very much like a memo detailing a normal man's slightly odd day. Even the punctuation in the chapter up to this point has been very mundane and businesslike. Very limited italics and ellipses, lots of semicolons and periods. And then they drift off to sleep, and we drift into the world of magic. And this is where we meet Albus Dumbledore and Minerva McGonagall. J.K. Rowling is so good at physical descriptions. As she's describing this tall, thin man who appeared on Privet Drive as if out of nowhere, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I almost get the feeling of the narrator being a close friend and confidant to us, describing Professor Dumbledore with this kind of wry sense of humor and comfortability. This type of physical description continues through the series, which allows for Rowling to really mold who these characters become in our minds in a unique way that not many authors know how to. Rowling's ability to convey physical attributes of a person, place, or thing is one of my favorite things about her writing style. It endears me to the narrator, allowing the narrator and me to almost bond over their witty and sharp descriptions. As we spend the next few pages with Dumbledore and McGonagall, we are told the story of Harry Potter and what has happened to this little baby. It seemed that Professor McGonagall had reached the point she was most anxious to discuss, the real reason she had been waiting on that cold, hard wall all day, for neither as a cat nor as a woman had she fixed Dumbledore with such a piercing stare as she did now. It was plain that whatever everyone was saying, she was not going to believe it until Dumbledore told her it was true. Dumbledore, however, was choosing another lemon drop and did not answer. "What they're saying," she pressed on, "is that last night Voldemort turned up in Godric's Hollow. He went to find the Potters. The rumor is that Lily and James Potter are dead." Dumbledore bowed his head. Professor McGonagall gasped. "Lily and James, I can't believe it. I didn't want to believe it. Oh, Albus." Dumbledore reached out and patted her on the shoulder.
I know, he said heavily.
Professor McGonagall's voice trembled as she went on. "That's not all. They're saying he tried to kill the Potter's son, Harry. But he couldn't. He couldn't kill that little boy. No one knows why or how, but they're saying that when he couldn't kill Harry Potter, Voldemort's power somehow broke, and that's why he's gone." Dumbledore nodded glumly. It's true?" faltered Professor McGonagall. "After all he's done, all the people he's killed, he couldn't kill a little boy? It's just astounding. Of all the things to stop him. But how in the name of heaven did Harry survive?"
"We can only guess," said Dumbledore. "We may never know."
This passage is so dense. There is so much here. I love the intimacy that we see between Dumbledore and McGonagall. This is one of the most intimate moments that we get to see between these two in the entire series, and I am just in love with it. In just two pages, Rowling lets us in on a relationship that has been developing over decades of living and working together. It's really beautiful. And then Dumbledore reveals that he plans on leaving Harry with the Dursleys, and McGonagall is the voice of all of us in the audience.
"Dumbledore, you can't! I've been watching them all day. You couldn't find two people who are less like us. And they've got this son. I saw him kicking his mother all the way up the street, screaming for sweets. Harry Potter, come and live here?"
"It's the best place for him," said Dumbledore firmly. "His aunt and uncle will be able to explain everything to him when he's older. I've written them a letter."
"A letter?" repeated Professor McGonagall faintly, sitting back down on the wall. "Really, Dumbledore, you think you can explain all this in a letter? These people will never understand him. He'll be famous, a legend. I wouldn't be surprised if today was known as Harry Potter Day in the future. There will be books written about Harry. Every child in our world will know his name."
And then one of the most lovely characters in the entire series flies in, carrying our infant hero. A low, rumbling sound had broken the silence around them. It grew steadily louder as they looked up and down the street for some sign of a headlight. It swelled to a roar as they both looked up at the sky, and a huge motorcycle fell out of the air and landed on the road in front of them. If the motorcycle was huge, it was nothing to the man sitting astride it. He was almost twice as tall as a normal man, and at least five times as wide. He looked simply too big to be allowed, and so wild. Long tangles of bushy black hair and beard hid most of his face. He had hands the size of trash can lids, and his feet in their leather boots were like baby dolphins. In his vast, muscular arms, he was holding a bundle of blankets.
"Hagrid," said Dumbledore, sounding relieved. "At last. And where did you get that motorcycle?"
"Borrowed it, Professor Dumbledore, sir," said the giant, climbing carefully off the motorcycle as he spoke. "Young Potter here fell asleep as we was flying over Bristol."
Dumbledore and McGonagall bent forward over the bundle of blankets. Inside, just visible, was a baby boy, fast asleep. Under a tuft of jet-black hair over his forehead, they could see a curiously shaped cut, like a bolt of lightning.
"Is that where?" whispered Professor McGonagall. "Yes," said Dumbledore. "He'll have that scar forever."
"Couldn't you do something about it, Dumbledore?"
"Even if I could, I wouldn't. Scars can come in handy. I have one myself above my left knee that is a perfect map of the London Underground.
Well, give him here, Hagrid. We'd better get this over with."
Dumbledore took Harry in his arms and turned toward the Dursleys' house.
Could I say goodbye to him, sir?" asked Hagrid.
He bent his great shaggy head over Harry and gave him what must have been a very scratchy, whiskery kiss. Then suddenly, Hagrid let out a howl like a wounded dog. Where Rowling used physical description to paint the picture of Albus Dumbledore, she now uses a character's unique way of speaking to paint them. Hagrid's voice is distinct and unique in that his dialect and cadence are unlike any other character in the series. Rowling is so consistent in the specificity with which she writes Hagrid's voice that if you were to put a paragraph of his dialogue with absolutely no context in front of me, I could tell you that the person speaking is Rubeus Hagrid, keeper of keys and games at Hogwarts. We'll get into Hagrid more as the book progresses, but I just want to put it out there that Hagrid should be protected at all costs. Dumbledore turned and walked back down the street. On the corner, he stopped and took out the silver put-outer. He clicked it once, and 12 balls of light sped back to their street lamps so that Privet Drive glowed suddenly orange, and he could make out a tabby cat slinking around the corner at the other end of the street. He could just see the bundle of blankets on the step of number 4.
"Good luck, Harry," he murmured.
He turned on his heel, and with a swish of his cloak, he was gone. A breeze ruffled the neat hedges of Privet Drive, which lay silent and tidy under the inky sky, the very last place you would expect astonishing things to happen. Harry Potter rolled over inside his blankets without waking up. One small hand closed on the letter beside him, and he slept on, not knowing he was special, not knowing he was famous, not knowing he would be woken in a few hours' time by Mrs. Dursley's scream as she opened the front door to put out the milk bottles, nor that he would spend the next few weeks being prodded and pinched by his cousin Dudley. He couldn't know that at this very moment people meeting in secret all over the country were holding up their glasses and saying in hushed voices, "To Harry Potter, the boy who lived." And that's how we wrap up chapter 1. And then we skip forward 11 years, where we find Harry, a scrawny boy with broken glasses, who lives in the cupboard under the stairs. As predicted by Professor McGonagall in the previous chapter, Harry's life with the Dursleys has been, let's just say, less than magical. And so we move into chapter 2, The Vanishing Glass. "Up!" she screeched. Harry heard her walking towards the kitchen, and then the sound of the frying pan being put on the stove. He rolled onto his back and tried to remember the dream he had been having. It had been a good one. There had been a flying motorcycle in it. He had a funny feeling he'd had the same dream before. His aunt was back outside the door.
"Are you up yet?" she demanded.
"Nearly," said Harry.
Well, get a move on. I want you to look after the bacon. And don't you dare let it burn. I want everything perfect on Duddy's birthday. Harry groaned. What did you say? His aunt snapped through the door. Nothing, nothing. Dudley's birthday. How could he have forgotten? Harry got slowly out of bed and started looking for socks. He found a pair under his bed and, after pulling a spider off of one of them, put them on. Harry was used to spiders, because the cupboard under the stairs was full of them, and that was where he slept. Right out of the gate, from the first paragraph of this chapter, it is made painfully obvious that Professor McGonagall was right, and that Harry is an outsider in the place meant to be his home. He has been raised in a home that not only denies him the ability to practice magic, but also denies the existence of his people. Harry doesn't even know who his parents truly were, who he is. He doesn't know that he has a community. Harry believes that he is a boy without community, without belonging. These two vital pieces of childhood development are missing. On top of feeling isolated socially and emotionally, Harry also feels like there is something wrong with him because his powers have been manifesting themselves, which, for a wizard, is totally normal, by the way. The problem was, strange things often happened around Harry, and it was just no good telling the Dursleys he didn't make them happen. Once, Aunt Petunia, tired of Harry coming back from the barber's, looking as though he hadn't been at all, had taken a pair of kitchen scissors and cut his hair so short he was almost bald, except for his bangs, which she left to hide that horrible scar. Dudley had laughed himself silly at Harry, who spent a sleepless night imagining school was the next day, where he was already laughed at for his baggy clothes and taped glasses. Next morning, however, he had gotten up to find his hair exactly as it had been before Aunt Petunia had sheared it off. He had been given a week in his cupboard for this, even though he had tried to explain that he couldn't explain how it had grown back so quickly. Another time, Aunt Petunia had been trying to force him into a revolting old sweater of Dudley's, brown with orange puffballs. The harder she tried to pull it over his head, the smaller it seemed to become, until finally it might have fitted a hand puppet, but certainly wouldn't fit Harry. Aunt Petunia had decided it must have shrunk in the wash, and, to his great relief, Harry wasn't punished. On the other hand, he'd gotten into terrible trouble for being found on the roof of the school kitchens. Dudley's gang had been chasing him as usual when, as though to Harry's surprise as much as anyone else's, there he was sitting on the chimney. The Dursleys had received a very angry letter from Harry's headmistress telling them Harry had been climbing school buildings. But all he tried to do, as he shouted at Uncle Vernon through the locked door of his cupboard, was jump behind the big trash cans outside the kitchen doors. Harry supposed that the wind must have caught him mid-jump. But today, nothing was going to go wrong. It was even worth being with Dudley and Piers, to be spending the day somewhere that wasn't school, his cupboard, or Mrs. Fig's cabbage-smelling living room. Insert mandatory Mrs. Fig appreciation here. For those of you reading Harry Potter for the first time, we'll cover that in about 4 books, give or take. What we're doing in these first few pages of the chapter is what Rowling does in the beginning of almost every book in the series, and that is establishing how incredibly out of place Harry is with the Dursleys, and how terribly he needs to find his people, to find who he is. We'll talk more about that in later books, but I do want to start tracking that now. So the Dursleys and Harry drive off to the zoo for Dudley's birthday, and in true Harry fashion, nothing goes as planned for the scrawny boy wizard. Dudley quickly found the largest snake in the place. It could have wrapped its body twice around Uncle Vernon's car and crushed it into a trash can. But at the moment, it didn't look in the mood. In fact, it was fast asleep. Dudley stood with his nose pressed against the glass, staring at the glistening brown coils. "Make it move," he whined at his father. Uncle Vernon tapped on the glass, but the snake didn't budge. "Do it again," Dudley ordered.
Uncle Vernon rapped the glass smartly with his knuckles, but the snake just snoozed on. "This is boring," Dudley moaned. He shuffled away. Harry moved in front of the tank and looked intently at the snake. He wouldn't have been surprised if it had died of boredom itself. No company except stupid people drumming their fingers on the glass trying to disturb it all day long. It was worse than having a cupboard as a bedroom, where the only visitor was Aunt Petunia hammering on the door to wake you up. At least he got to visit the rest of the house. The snake suddenly opened its beady eyes. Slowly, very slowly, it raised its head until its eyes were on a level with Harry's. It winked. Harry stared. Then he looked quickly around to see if anyone was watching. They weren't. He looked back at the snake and winked, too. The snake jerked its head towards Uncle Vernon and Dudley, then raised its eyes to the ceiling. It gave Harry a look that said quite plainly, "I get that all the time." Harry peered at it. Boa constrictor Brazil. Was it nice there? The boa constrictor jabbed its tail at the sign again, and Harry read on. "This specimen was bred in the zoo." "Oh, I see. So you've never been to Brazil?" As the snake shook its head, a deafening shout behind Harry made both of them jump.
"Dudley! Mr. Dursley! Come and look at the snake! You won't believe what it's doing!"
Dudley came waddling toward them as fast as he could.
"Out of the way, you,"
he said, punching Harry in the ribs. Caught by surprise, Harry fell hard on the concrete floor. What came next happened so fast no one saw how it happened. One second, Piers and Dudley were leaning right up close to the glass. The next, they had leapt back with howls of horror. Harry sat up and gasped. The glass front of the boa constrictor's tank had vanished. The great snake was uncoiling itself rapidly, slithering out onto the floor. People throughout the reptile house screamed and started running for the exits. As the snake slid swiftly past him, Harry could have sworn a low, hissing voice said,
"Brazil, here I come. Thanks, amigo."
Okay, there is so much I want to talk about with you guys about this scene that's kind of spoilery, so I'll have to save that for our final episode of this season, where we'll talk about how this book plays into further plots and story arcs. But beyond all my crackpot fan theories about this scene, it serves as a wonderfully disjointed jump into magic. It almost feels like we were on the non-magic train tracks, and very violently were jumped to the parallel running magic train tracks. It's a really delightful scene, giving us a first-hand look at Harry's magic materializing in front of him without his control. Harry lay in his dark cupboard much later, wishing he had a watch. He didn't know what time it was, and he couldn't be sure the Dursleys weren't asleep yet. Until they were, he couldn't risk sneaking to the kitchen for some food. He'd lived with the Dursleys almost 10 years, 10 miserable years, as long as he could remember, ever since he'd been a baby and his parents had died in that car crash. He couldn't remember being in the car when his parents had died. Sometimes, when he strained his memory during long hours in his cupboard, he came up with a strange vision. A blinding flash of green light, and a burning pain on his forehead. This, he supposed, was the crash, though he couldn't imagine where all the green light came from. He couldn't remember his parents at all. His aunt and uncle never spoke about them, and, of course, he was forbidden to ask questions. There were no photographs of them in the house. When he had been younger, Harry had dreamed and dreamed of some unknown relation coming to take him away, but it had never happened. The Dursleys were his only family. Yet sometimes he thought, or maybe hoped, that strangers in the street seemed to know him. Very strange strangers they were, too. A tiny man in a violet top hat had bowed to him once while out shopping with Aunt Petunia and Dudley. After asking Harry furiously if he knew the man, Aunt Petunia had rushed them out of the shop without buying anything. A wild-looking old woman dressed all in green had waved merrily at him once on a bus. A bald man in a very long purple coat had actually shaken his hand in the street the other day and then walked away without a word. The weirdest thing about all these people was the way they seemed to vanish the second Harry tried to get a closer look. In last week's intro episode, I mentioned that one of the reasons that children are drawn to this series to begin with is that Harry is the embodiment of this desire that a lot of kids have to belong, and the feeling that they don't truly belong anywhere. Harry truly does not belong anywhere, that he knows of at least. And his desire is that someone would come to him and spirit him away to a family and a place where he belongs. If that's not relatable in the most painfully adolescent way, I'm not really sure what is. As a child, I was drawn to Harry. Here was this boy who feels the same way that I do, alone, out of place. And he gets to be who and what I dreamed of being, loved, accepted, meaningful, important. In one chapter, Rowling earns the trust of her childhood audience, as well as endears Harry to us. In a later episode, I'll point out to you where exactly I think that I would be all in on this story if I were reading it for the first time as an adult. But for me, I think this second chapter is what brings in almost any child reading this story. Moving on to chapter 3, The Letters from No One, Harry and the Dursleys are making the most of their summer holidays. Dudley and his friends are quote-unquote Harry hunting. Harry is trying to avoid all contact with the Dursleys. And Vernon and Petunia are excitedly preparing to send Dudley to Vernon's alma mater, Smeltings Private High School. All is normal and non-magical until one day, everything changes. They heard the click of the mail slot and flop of letters on the doormat.
"Get the mail, Dudley," said Uncle Vernon from behind his paper. "Make Harry get it." "Get the mail, Harry."
"Make Dudley get it."
"Poke him with your smelting stick, Dudley."
Harry dodged the smelting stick and went to get the mail. Three things lay on the doormat: a postcard from Uncle Vernon's sister Marge, who was vacationing on the Isle of Wight, a brown envelope that looked like a bill, and a letter for Harry. Harry picked it up and stared at it, his heart twanging like a giant elastic band. No one ever in his whole life had written to him. Who would? He had no friends, no other relatives. He didn't belong to the library, so he had never even got rude notes asking for books back. Yet here it was, a letter, addressed so plainly there could be no mistake.
"Mr. H. Potter, the cupboard under the stairs, 4 Privet Drive, Little Whinging, Surrey."
The envelope was thick and heavy, made of yellowish parchment, and the address was written in emerald green ink. There was no stamp. Turning the envelope over, his hand trembling, Harry saw a purple wax seal bearing a coat of arms, a lion, an eagle, a badger, and a snake surrounding a large letter H. We don't even have the name of the school from which this letter is coming. Harry doesn't even know the contents of the letter, and he already senses the magic of it. Do you notice a difference in the adjectives Rowling uses to describe this letter compared to the adjectives used so far to describe Harry's non-magic surroundings? The colors are bold, Rowling using emerald green and purple, which are notably colors only used so far to describe the wardrobe of odd people around Harry. Everything in the non-magical world is drab, and we are getting little tastes of this other world, one of magic, that is drawn in bold colors. Well, as you might imagine, Petunia and Vernon are not pleased by the letter, or the contents, which are still unknown to Harry. Vernon does everything he can, sleeping by the front door, boarding up the front door, boarding up the fireplace, to stop this barrage of letters for Harry. Finally, Vernon gives up and decides to take his family and get away from the letters, convinced that the magic letters from the magic school can't find them on vacation. It was freezing in the boat. Icy sea spray and rain crept down their necks and a chilly wind whipped their faces. After what seemed like hours, they reached the rock where Vernon, slipping and sliding, led the way to the broken-down house. The inside was horrible. It smelled strongly of seaweed, the wind whistling through the gaps in the wooden walls, and the fireplace was damp and empty. There were only two rooms. Uncle Vernon's rations turned out to be a bag of chips each and four bananas. He tried to start a fire, but the empty chip bags just smoked and shriveled up.
"Could do with some of those letters now, eh?" he said cheerfully.
He was in a very good mood. Obviously, he thought nobody stood a chance of reaching them here in a storm to deliver mail. Harry privately agreed, though the thought didn't cheer him up at all. As night fell, the promised storm blew up around them. Spray from the high waves splattered the walls of the hut, and a fierce wind rattled the filthy windows. Aunt Petunia found a few moldy blankets in the second room and made up a bed for Dudley on the moth-eaten sofa. She and Uncle Vernon went off to the lumpy bed next door, and Harry was left to find the softest bit of floor he could and to curl up under the thinnest, most ragged blanket. The storm raged more and more ferociously as the night went on. Harry couldn't sleep. He shivered and turned over, trying to get comfortable, his stomach rumbling with hunger. Dudley's snores were drowned by the low rolls of thunder that started near midnight. The lighted dial of Dudley's watch, which was dangling over the edge of the sofa on his fat wrist, told Harry he'd be 11 in 10 minutes' time. He lay and watched his birthday tick nearer, wondering if the Dursleys would remember at all, wondering where the letter writer was now. 5 minutes to go. Harry heard something creak outside. He hoped the roof wasn't going to fall in, although he might be warmer if it did. 4 minutes to go. Maybe the house in Privet Drive would be so full of letters when they got back that he'd be able to steal one somehow. 3 minutes to go. Was that the sea slapping hard on the rock like that? And 2 minutes to go. What was that funny crunching noise? Was the rock crumbling into the sea? 1 minute to go and he'd be 11. 30 seconds. 20. 10. 9. Maybe he'd wake Dudley up just to annoy him. 3. 2. 1. Boom! The whole shack shivered, and Harry sat bolt upright, staring at the door. Someone was outside, knocking to come in. And that's how we conclude Chapter 3. The Wizarding World is literally trying to knock the door down on the mundanity that is the Dursleys. If there's one lesson to be learned from Vernon Dursley in this chapter, it's that you can run, but you cannot hide from the Wizarding World. I don't know about you, but I am so excited to get to next week's episode. We properly meet Rubeus Hagrid, as well as being thrown right into the bright, shiny world of Diagon Alley, Gringotts Bank, and we get the Hogwarts Express! Buckle your seatbelts, kids. It's going to be a magical ride. Next week, we will cover chapters 4, 5, and 6 of Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone. As always, please make sure to like and subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Gretchen_BADGRR. And you can find the podcast on Twitter and Instagram at StoryIncPod. That's at StoryIncPod. Birdie Bot's Every Flavor Pod is part of the Story Inc. Podcast Network. Please help us out by supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/storyincpod. I'd love to hear from you, so please reach out to me either via social media or email the podcast at storyincpodcasts@gmail.com. Again, that's storyincpodcasts@gmail.com. Until next time, take a seat and have a biscuit, Potter.